answered any stupid questions. I had just walked away. Son of a gun. Is this what maturity felt like? Chapter 15. Somehow all the kids were waiting out front when I pulled up in the van. Johnny, the doorman, couldn't look me in the face when I stopped at the curb. I'd said stupid things before. I knew how he felt. I wasn't going to make it any worse, but I wasn't going to make it any easier either. The kids filed in as always, youngest in the back, leading up to the oldest in the most comfortable forward seats. You see, when you have so many kids, you can't leave things to chance. You buy a big-ass van like this Ford Super Duty 12-passenger monster and then assign seats. It was a microcosm of the country. When you allow for too much choice, it always leads to some form of chaos. For a change, we weren't racing the 8:45 deadline at Holy Name. Sister Helen, who had been taking over more of the early morning duties, looked shocked to see the van pull up almost 6 minutes early, a new record. She even walked over to the van and leaned in the door as the kids scooted past her. "And how are you this morning, Michael?" "Fine, Sister Helen, and you?" "Like everyone else around here, thanking God you're safe." She wandered off without another word to me. It may have been the sweetest thing anyone from a Catholic school had said to me since I was 6 years old. It gave me a little jolt to get my day started. I burned up my phone on my ride north. After I stashed the van in a parking lot in Washington Heights, I had my first meeting in a Starbucks. I hate the chain restaurants and coffee houses. I also hate that I like Starbucks coffee. But I had to go where people were willing to talk to me, and this was where Detective Teresita Hernandez wanted to meet. The 8-year veteran was waiting for me as I stepped through the front door, sitting alone at a 2-person high top in the corner where no one would hear us. As I approached, she slid a cup across the small round table. She smiled as she said, "I remember old goats like you prefer simple black coffee." I had to laugh. She'd come a long way from a rookie detective in Manhattan North Homicide 5 years ago. We caught up for a few minutes. She was working on her master's degree in public administration at City College. Picturing Teresita on a college campus, I laughed at the idea of some young undergrad hitting on her. He'd think he was trying to impress a beautiful co-ed with long dark hair, and she'd be deciding whether to break him in half like a pretzel. Teresita had been my muscle sometimes when she worked in our squad. No street criminal worth his salt would ever admit that a female had roughed him up. Tough and fearless, she'd left one of the best jobs in the department because she believed she could make more of a difference in the Bronx. It was probably true, and I respected it. I said, "Your dad must be glad you're working on a master's degree." She shrugged. "He wanted me to join him in his accounting firm, but he sees what a difference a good cop can make, so he's supportive. Quietly. Real quietly." Finally, we got around to business when I said, "I don't want to get you in any trouble, Terry. Thanks for meeting me." She waved me off. "How can I get in trouble when I'm not on duty yet and this isn't an official meeting?" She waited a moment and added, "See, I learned a lot from you in homicide. Besides, you saved my ass plenty of times." To be clear, I'm trying to help on the homicide of the nurse and her daughter, even though I saw the suspect during my own shooting incident. "The Bronx is getting stirred up about it. The Reverend Caldwell has been banging the drum pretty hard." I said I could see why he would. A white cop shoots a black resident. Terry laughed. "The Reverend doesn't see black and white. When something like this happens, he only sees green. You can't believe how much money he collects. I heard he also gets a cut of any negotiated settlement." I moved back to what I was interested in. "You ever heard of a guy with the street name Tight?" She shrugged, then took a quick look around the room. It was a police habit, but she was also making sure no one could hear us. "Just from our homicide guys, they say he's a possible suspect in our nasty double. The report I read said you gave the detectives the name after your shooting. From the description, he sounds like an oxy addict and crazy, scary crazy. So you don't know him?
No,
and I haven't been able to find out anything about him. I don't know if it's from fear or that he moves around a lot. He's not clearly visible in the footage of your shooting. He stayed off to the side. Then there's a blurry image as he backed away from you and tried to pull his gun.
That surprised me. There's video of my shooting?
Yeah, but you can't tell anyone.
I was only allowed to see it because I'm helping with a mother-daughter homicide, but the footage is pretty clear. The guy you shot, Ronald Timmons Jr., had the drop on you. You show good tactics. You should teach.
I laughed out loud and said, "No one ever has suggested that before."
Terry said, "Teach tactics, not tact.
Or attitude.
Or procedures.
I get it, I get it.
Or respect for command, or..."
I left the Starbucks smiling.
Chapter 16. My next meeting was a few blocks away. It wasn't at a Starbucks. I saw the man waiting for me in Convent Garden on 151st Street. It was just cool enough that some of the remarkable flowers the place was known for were not blooming, and the wooden gazebo was empty. This should be a quick, casual meeting. I approached the skinny African-American man from the opposite end of the park. He stood in the shadow of a tree in a corner. I wanted to give him a chance to look around and to see me clearly. Maybe I was getting a little paranoid, but informants were not known for their loyalty, and there'd been more and more ambushes of police officers across the country. His lanky frame leaned against a section of the tall metal fence that surrounded the park. The way he scratched his arm and shuffled back and forth on his feet made me realize he wasn't using. Sometimes that was good, and sometimes it was bad. I could never tell how it affected the information provided. He noticed me. His eyes darted all around the park and the bits of street that could be seen beyond the bushes. He didn't want to be seen talking to me, and I couldn't blame him. No informant wants to be seen talking to a cop, especially a cop whose face had been plastered all over the news. He looked nervous, but then again, he always did. I said, "Hey Flash, you doing okay?" I had never asked him how he got his street name. I probably didn't want to know. It was my hope he was just a fast runner. He merely nodded and scratched his neck with both hands. He looked frantic. I said, "Can't score anywhere?" He said, "Does it look like I scored? Everyone come down so hard on pain pills, can't find nothing. H is easier to score. Don't make no sense." I liked that he was comfortable enough with me to discuss felonies. But if cops only dealt with Boy Scouts as informants, nothing would ever get done. It wasn't the 70s, and I wasn't in narcotics, so I wouldn't let him shoot up even if he had some. It was a tough part of the job that no one ever talked about. Dealing with informants meant you were dealing with criminals and drug users. I said, "Did you find out anything about the guy named Tite?"
"Could be I know him. Skinny as me. A little shorter. Dude's wrapped way too tight. That's how he got his street name."
He ran a hand over his close-cropped hair, then scratched it. He dug in his ear, too. I waited as he inspected whatever had come from his ear. I said, "Real name?" He shrugged his narrow shoulders. "Who knows?" His brown eyes took another look around the green space.
"I seen him around. He likes the pills just like me. He hit him a lot harder than I do. Says it's his medicine."
I didn't think I had to add that technically it was medicine. It was just that people like him had ruined a useful tool for people in pain. I said, "You know anything that can help me find this Tite?" Flash shook his head. We stood in an awkward silence until he said,
"Ain't you gonna ask me about the kid you shot, Ronald Timmons Jr.?"
"Nope. Separate investigation. I'm just the subject in that one.
The Reverend Caldwell sees it different. He's got everyone in the Bronx thinking you just killed that boy. I knew RJ. He wasn't a bad kid."
"He made a bad choice.
The good Reverend says you're a killer."
I thought, at least I'm not dead. It was hard for anyone to understand a police shooting. Cops make mistakes, they're human, but they also have to deal with something like 50,000 assaults a year.
How many of those would result in police fatalities if not for training? No one would ever convince the Reverend Caldwell of that line of reasoning. I walked out of Convent Garden, feeling down again. Chapter 17. Harry Grissom was curt on the phone. He said he'd pick me up at my apartment in 20 minutes. I told him I needed 45 to get ready. Really, I needed to race home and act like I hadn't done any unauthorized investigations today. Harry was his usual gruff self when I slid into the front seat of his Suburban. No questions, no smart-ass comments, and show some respect. I had to ask. Where are we going? What did I just tell you? Enjoy the ride. That's what they used to tell inmates on their way to Sing Sing. That's a good metaphor, even if you just made it up. That didn't make me feel any better as we drove south on West Street. Like a little kid, to make sure I didn't ask stupid questions, I tried to occupy myself. I guessed where we were going. We had passed a building that housed the DEA, which eliminated one choice. Of course, One Police Plaza was the most likely stop. That's where the big brass could really lay into me if they thought it might help their position. The public opinion shift on cops was slow to sweep over the profession, but now that it had, some politically minded managers would do anything to make the department look better. That could mean sacrificing a detective like me. Oh, they'd say it was based on facts and evidence, but I'd know better. And there would be little I could do about it. This line of thought raised my anxiety a lot. Now I was nervous. Then Harry turned east on Chambers Street, and I knew we were headed to One Police Plaza. All the thoughts I just had seemed to be coming true. Then he surprised me by taking a right on Broadway and pulling into the City Hall complex. What's going on, Harry? I could tell he was considering what he should tell me. I feel like I'm headed to a firing squad. We passed through security and Harry pulled into a spot right by City Hall. He turned to me and said, "You're going to be cleared on the shooting. We've got the suspect's pistol and two casings. We have security video from the bodega that shows everything. Forensics all check out. Plus, everyone knows you're not a rookie. But IA and the officials here wanted to make sure everything was done right and covered properly." I felt like a weight had been lifted off my chest. I wanted to kiss Harry right on the cheek. I didn't care what kind of stubble he had. I said, "That's great. When can I get back to work? I've got a lot to catch up on." Tight was the main thing on my mind. I had to find the skinny psychopath and get the truth about the murder of the nurse and her daughter. The image of the crime scene was burned into my memory. And Mrs. Evans breaking down and crying out her son's apartment would never leave my head. It was the best motivation a cop could have. "Can you run me by the office to get my car?" "Slow down, Mike. It's a complicated situation. The mayor's office has some concerns about how the public would view a return so quick." "You mean it's politics?" "You can call it anything you want, but we have a meeting in here right now. You're going to talk to the mayor himself." "The LFP? No shit. If I get the sense you're even thinking of saying the words, little fat prick, I will personally throw your kid's cat off the balcony and let you deal with the chaos." "You do that to Saki after I did it to you." Normally, I'd think that was kind of a funny comment. Coming from Harry Grissom, it felt more like a realistic threat. I recognized a couple of cops in uniform. They all patted me on the back or shoulder. It wasn't the kind of greeting I usually got, but what they were really saying was they were glad I was alive, even if it meant someone else was dead. We took the stairs to the third floor and turned down a long corridor. We stopped at an office with a sign that said, "Office of the Mayor, Communications." I started to ask Harry why we were here. He shut me up with just a look. He knocked once, then opened the door. There were three people in the large plush office. A woman stepped up and offered her hand. "I'm Carol Tedesco, Director of Communications." She was polished and professional. She looked like she could be TV ready at any moment. The thin man in wire-rimmed glasses didn't bother to stand up straight from the table he was leaning on. He just waved and said, "Clark Higson, assistant to the mayor." Then the other man stepped over to me and offered a pudgy paw. He said, "Alfred Hanna, nice to meet you." He wasn't quite as short as I thought he would be. Chapter 18. Alfred Hanna had slipped into the mayor's office by the thinnest of margins. Every cop in the city used the term LFP for little fat prick to refer to him. I had even heard LFP used on the radio. Since his election, he had managed to piss off virtually all city workers, the Puerto Rican population, Staten Island residents, and even tourists when he'd referred to a group from Arkansas touring City Hall as a bunch of rednecks. Nothing anyone else in the city wouldn't have said, but the mayor was held to a higher standard, barely. In short, Alfred Hanna was a true New Yorker. He ran a nervous hand over his slicked back dark hair. The long blue tie did little to cover his extended belly. He looked a little like a chipmunk in an Armani suit. He reached up to put his arm across my shoulders. "We need to keep this meeting as quiet as possible. That's why we're not in my office. Is that understood?" Both Harry and I mumbled, "Yes, sir." He released me and turned to face all of us. He looked at me and said, "I'm very proud of your service to the city. I'm sorry you got put in a position like you did. I know you acted well within policy and did everything you could not to shoot that young man." I didn't get excited at his little speech. Anyone could tell there was a but coming. Harry gave me a really good command stare to keep me quiet. Mayor Hanna continued, "The problem is that the Timmons family is quite popular. The fact that they brought in Reverend Caldwell means they're not going to listen to the results of any investigation. They're also not going to disappear. That means you returning to your regular job would not only look bad for the city, it could also be dangerous for you." I said, "You don't think a cop's job is dangerous anyway?" I hadn't meant to put the edge in my voice. "Okay, more dangerous than usual. Look, my grandfather on my mother's side was a cop in Queens. I understand the hardships you guys go through." It surprised me the mayor had a family member who'd been a cop, but it didn't surprise me that he actually thought he knew. Everyone thought they understood the job. The mayor said, "I don't want to send the wrong message to our city's police officers. I don't want them to step back. I don't advocate less proactive policing. I also don't think you should have to go back to work looking over your shoulder for a retribution attack, not when we have an alternative." I said, "So what's this alternate plan you're talking about?" "Like I said, anything talked about in this room stays here." He turned his bowling ball head to look at each of us individually. Everyone agreed. The mayor looked right at me and said, "I've heard that, among your many talents, you know how to find people. I've located a few fugitives. This is a missing person. Why don't you have our missing person squad look into it?" "Because it's my daughter." Chapter 19. I read the mayor's expression almost like I would a homicide suspect during an interview. He was uncomfortable. I looked across the office at the only one who might understand what I was seeing. Harry just shrugged and shifted his eyes to the door in the back of the office. I said, "Maybe we can speak more freely in private." The mayor, who was clearly shaken, turned to the door that Harry had pointed out. He motioned for his aides to stay in this office, and I followed his odd gait. The other room was a small conference room with a table big enough for about 6 people. A giant portrait of the late former mayor Fiorello LaGuardia filled the upper half of one wall. Every mayor wanted to be like LaGuardia, except Ed Koch, who had seemed pretty happy being himself. A window looked down on the parking lot. I could just see the top of Harry's Suburban. The mayor and I settled into leather chairs at one corner of the table. I gave him a moment to collect himself, then said gently, "Do you want to tell me about your daughter?" I thought you only had two young boys.
I took a moment and said, Natalie is from my first marriage. It ended in a divorce, a messy public divorce. Natalie even uses her mother's maiden name of London. It was my fault. Not only the divorce, but allowing it to be so public. It cost me an election as an alderman. He took another moment and added, I've changed. More than anyone can believe, especially my ex-wife and daughter. I read that you have daughters yourself. 6. Good Lord. And 4 boys. Oh my God. I haven't heard of a Catholic family like that since I was a kid. Back then, every neighborhood had 2 or 3 families with 8-plus kids. How do you manage? First of all, I am Catholic, but all my kids are adopted. And second, I don't manage anything. We're a family. We all work together. Kind of the way it's supposed to be with the city. Everyone works for the greater good. If only. No matter how we come down on a decision, there's always about half the population that's pissed off. I like the idea in principle, but in reality, you have a unique family. You have no idea. I envy you, detective. You know what's important and appreciated. I learned that lesson a little late in life. Now I just hope it's not too late. He took a moment to wipe his eyes with an embroidered handkerchief. Let me show you my Natalie. He held up his phone. A photo of a smiling brunette in a cap and gown filled the screen. A tall woman, who I assumed was her mother, held an arm around her shoulders, and the mayor stood off at a distance, smiling. He said, This was her high school graduation. She was on her way to MIT a few months later. She was a computer prodigy. Even as a child, she learned to change the code on programs to fit her needs. She's amazing. I thought of Eddie. Would I be able to afford MIT? Would he get a scholarship? I had a number of kids to get through college. I hoped I could figure out a way. The mayor continued. Natalie went off the rails a little bit. Her grades dropped. She was more interested in pushing the envelope than learning the basics of computer science. She started to party more. She and I grew more distant. She got bounced out of MIT. A few months ago, she enrolled in City College, but it didn't last. I listened, and all I heard was an anguished father. I didn't hear the politician I saw on TV regularly. I didn't see the man cops grumbled about every single day. The mayor wiped his eyes again with his bare thumb, then said, Now she's 21. No one has heard from her in 3 weeks. Her mother's frantic. Frantic enough to ask me for help. Some of her friends said she fell in with some hackers. I don't know, but I'm scared. Now I was in familiar territory, talking to a frightened parent. I could deal with this. I understood this. I said, It'll be okay, Mr. Mayor. We'll find her. His eyes were rimmed red when he looked up. His voice was much softer. He said, Really? You think so? Yes. I really did. The mayor sniffled. He said, I might be able to help you, detective. How so? This was always treacherous. People who thought they could help you also thought they could crush you if things didn't go the way they wanted. If you find my daughter, I might be able to help you with your son, Brian. I know about his unfortunate situation. I could make some calls, see what happens. He looked at me as if he expected me to say something. Then he added, Just one father helping another. Chapter 20. It took a little time to get everything together. I rode with Harry to pick up my car. On the way, he had one of his little talks with me. He called them talks. The squad called them lectures. Either way, we had learned it was stupid to ignore Harry's advice. He said, You need to stay under the radar. It doesn't help anyone if they know you're already back on the job. You had a tough break. You had to shoot that kid. I know the feeling. Things will get better. Eventually, smart people look past the crazy public outcries and examine the evidence and investigations. The mayor has just given you a shortcut to get back on the street. Don't blow it.
Who could refute such deep wisdom as, don't blow it? When I walked into the office, Terry Hernandez sat at the once empty desk next to mine. I said, what are you doing slumming down here?
Temporary duty assignment, supposed to fill in for some old geezer who was on suspension. I guess that didn't last long.
Well, I've gone from suspension into exile.
What happened?
Moving to a missing persons case. Low key, low profile, and low probability of excitement.
So you cleared in the shooting?
Not officially.
Well, who are you looking for?
Not supposed to talk about it.
Even to me? You used to tell me everything.
I wish I could, but I made a promise.
You and your promises. One day you'll promise someone too much and they'll get you in hot water.
That was probably today. Terry smiled.
I believe in you. Hell, even my dad asked about you.
I smiled.
How's Ramon? Irascible as ever.
He's a smart man. Listen to him. What's he always say? Marry rich and as many times as needed?
Actually, he likes to say, marry a rich old man, repeat if necessary. That's coming from a man who's been married 38 years.
Some guys are lucky. Not long after grabbing a few things from the office and trading jabs with Terry Hernandez, I was in the neighborhood of Natalie London's apartment near NYU. This was a younger neighborhood with an interesting vibe. The students from NYU mixed with young professionals and the occasional stockbroker from the financial district. The area was loaded with mom-and-pop restaurants, and that made me realize I hadn't eaten. I don't know if it was the relief of being back at work, but I was suddenly famished. I swung a few blocks out of my way to the Burger and Barrel. It was a little nicer and more expensive than my usual lunch places, but I reasoned it was well after lunch. If I didn't have some protein immediately, I might faint. Sometimes I'm dramatic even to myself. The sports bar sat right on Houston Street and looked a little touristy, but was known by the locals for its burgers. I wouldn't call it a cop hangout, but cops liked eating there. Service was decent, and the burgers outstanding. One of the TVs above the bar had the news on instead of ESPN. I didn't pay much attention until the camera cut away to a shot outside some city administration buildings. I saw the Reverend Caldwell speaking into a microphone like he was addressing a crowd of thousands. It took even me a moment to realize it was simply a one-on-one interview with the local reporter. All I heard him say was, "And now a murderer is walking free among us. Are the streets really safe?" The older African-American man behind the counter walked past the TV and absently switched it to Fox Sports 1. I didn't even mind the negative story about the Giants' offensive woes. Anything was better than hearing the tubby reverend call me names in public. In my notepad, I looked at the list of several names the mayor had come up with of Natalie's friends. A kid named Tom Payne, a woman named Chang, and a couple of other names. All of them supposedly computer people. I wolfed down my burger and even considered adding a beer to my tab. I stuck to a Coke and gathered my notes together. I caught the attention of the bartender. He was older than I'd thought, maybe in his early 70s, but he looked good, like an in-shape grandpa. I said, "Can I grab my bill?" He shook his head. "You don't get a bill. Thank you for your service." Holy cow, did I need to hear something like that about now. I laid a $10 tip on the bar. I was a little choked up and couldn't speak. That surprised me. The bartender said, "This too shall pass." That's what they told me when I came back from Vietnam. No one gave a damn about me. I remember walking through East Harlem in my uniform and someone threw a tomato at me. Another woman called me a baby killer. But they all came around. It may have taken 25 years, but people finally understood that we were just doing our duty. You'll see. The same attitude will come around about cops. In the meantime, stay safe. I had to shake the man's hand before I headed over to Natalie London's apartment. Chapter 21. I used the key the mayor had given me to slip into Natalie's apartment. I took a run through quickly to make sure no one was home. It would be embarrassing to discover her asleep in her bed. Stranger things have happened. Kids are called in missing all the time who end up being exactly where they're supposed to be. I had a case when I was in the Bronx of a missing 3-year-old. The call came in at about 4 p.m. The mom was frantic. She was also suspicious of her boyfriend. I made a cursory check of the apartment, then went looking for the boyfriend. I found him in a sports bar near Yankee Stadium. He had an attitude that was infuriating. He said, "Why are you bothering me about that brat? He's Valerie's problem, not mine." I thought he was lying. I asked him where the boy might go or what interested him. The man ignored me, watching a Yankees-Red Sox game on TV. No way I wanted to waste time. Every minute counted with a missing child. I wanted to threaten him or scare him in some way. He'd spent a year in Rikers awaiting trial on a robbery and been arrested 6 times over the years. I couldn't threaten much that would scare him. Then I had another idea. I'd let others threaten him. I took the remote from the bar and changed all the TVs at the same time to HGTV. The reaction was understandably outrage. I said in a loud voice, "I'll turn the game back on as soon as this man answers my questions about a missing boy, a 3-year-old. So you need to decide if it's easier to take the remote from me or make him talk." I noticed all the eyes in the place fall on the boyfriend. Someone said, "Why won't you help someone looking for a missing kid?" That was the nicest thing said. Quickly, the boyfriend realized the danger he was in and jumped up to tell me that his girlfriend's sister always took the boy without telling anyone. She felt like the boy was more hers than her sister's. 20 minutes later, I was back at the apartment asking about the mom's sister, Crystal Fuchs. According to the mom, Crystal was, let's just say, untrustworthy. They clearly didn't get along. I found Crystal Fuchs 2 blocks away. She was nothing like her sister had made her out to be. She was a bank teller who was concerned about her nephew. She took him some afternoons to give him a healthy meal and read to him. I was impressed. She said, "I'm surprised my sister and her no-good boyfriend even noticed he was missing." "To be fair, only your sister missed him. She seems nice, just in a difficult situation." "A situation she constantly puts herself in." "Have you seen your nephew?" "Of course. I put him to bed 1 hour ago. My sister never looked up from her phone." When I rushed back to the apartment and checked the boy's room, he was snoring, bundled in his blankets. That's why I always check every room in an apartment more than once during an investigation. Natalie's apartment looked fine. A little messy, but it was a typical 21-year-old's apartment, except that she had no roommates. That was unusual down here, where an apartment like this regularly went for more than $4,000 a month. The quick background I had done on Natalie and her mother hadn't shown any large incomes. I knew the mayor was proud of coming from the people. He lived on the mayor's $200,000 salary. That sounded like a lot of money, but in New York, even when you were living for free in Gracie Mansion, it didn't get you that far. There was no super in the building, so I called the leasing office. I explained to the property manager who I was and that I was looking for a missing person. The woman on the phone sounded helpful, and I found the office a few blocks away. The woman who met me at the office, Renee Schobert, was about my age and very well put together, in a professional dress with a colorful scarf. Her sandy hair draped down her right shoulder. Renee ushered me into her office, crammed with file cabinets. She said, "I pulled out Natalie's file after you called. There's nothing out of order or unusual, except her deposit and 6 full months of rent were paid at the same time." I said, "So you don't know her personally? Didn't ever visit the apartment?" She shook her head, then slid the open file across to me. She said, "The entire amount was wired here from Danske Bank in Tallinn, Estonia." I glanced at the wire transfer and wrote down the information on the bank. The address was Narva Man T 11
15015 Tallinn, Estonia. I wasn't sure what this meant, but I knew it was important. It was one of those gut feelings cops on TV always seem to have. They only came to me occasionally. It took me years to recognize them, and longer to trust those kinds of feelings. Just as I was finishing my notes, Renee Schobert looked closely at me and said, "Oh my God, you're the cop who's been on TV. The one who shot that kid in the Bronx." I nodded, hoping to get out of there quickly. She said, "How could you shoot an unarmed boy like that?" I could have explained to her what happened. I could have told her not to listen to some of the things she hears on TV, but I had a job to do. And I thank God that I had something to keep me occupied. That way I didn't focus on the exact question she had asked. I thanked her and slipped out of the office quickly. Chapter 22. I was glad to be home just as it was getting dark. I decided to play down anything I was doing, officially or otherwise. Mary Catherine still felt I needed a break, and yeah, I was too chicken shit to tell her I was back at work full time. Hiding exactly what I was doing at work didn't turn out to be a problem. Mary Catherine met me in the hallway as soon as I walked in. The way she hugged me, I knew something was up. I stepped back to look her in the eyes and said, "Tell me what's wrong." "After you've lost a wife to cancer and you've dealt with the problems of 10 kids, you rarely have time for people to beat around the bush. Not that Mary Catherine ever did." She came right to the point, as usual. "Some of the younger kids are upset. They were teased at school. Excuse my French, but that asshole, the Reverend Caldwell, stuck a microphone in Jane's face and asked her if you felt any guilt at all. That hurt. Any parent will tell you they would take any amount of abuse so their kids wouldn't have to." I said, "Is Jane upset? What did she say?" Then Mary Catherine let a smile slide across her beautiful face. "Oh, she used a few words that we don't allow in this house and the nuns at Holy Name would usually frown upon. Only in this case, Sister Sheila backed her up. She looked at the Reverend and said, 'Let's see you use that quote on TV, you jackass.'" I couldn't help but laugh. Mary Catherine said, "It was quite the scandal at school today. Things have quieted down now." Trent saw me and rushed over to give me a hug. He looked up at me with that sweet face and said, "Michael Sadecki and some of his friends said you were a racist." "Well, that seems like an odd thing to say to you." "I pointed out to them that I'm black, and I have a black sister, a Korean sister, and an Hispanic sister. They said it didn't matter. Then they said I was Mary Catherine offered, "Complicit?" Trent said, "Yeah, exactly. What's that mean anyway?" I said, "It means the kids were just being stupid." I kissed him on his head and hugged him. Nothing I had seen as a cop had ever affected me like the smallest injury to my children, physically or emotionally. When Trent hustled away to do his homework, I said to Mary Catherine, "Now, what exactly happened with the Reverend Caldwell?" "Sister Sheila dealt with him." I laughed out loud. No one had ever crossed Sheila twice, at least not by choice. Mary Catherine snuggled in close to me and wrapped her arms around my midsection. "Oh, this would be like a vacation. I can have you all to myself tomorrow." I said, She stepped back to look at me. I blurted, "I'll be back at work full time tomorrow." I held my breath. Mary Catherine didn't say a word. That was worse than anything else she could say or do. I was in real trouble. Chapter 23. I was stuck. I knew better than to chase after Mary Catherine immediately. She needed to calm down. Not that I would ever say that aloud. She once told me she felt it was in her DNA to blow up, then take a short time to calm down. This was a textbook example of one of those times. I ducked into the dining room where Eddie, Ricky, Trent, and the twins, Fiona and Bridget, were all in various stages of homework.
The long dining room table serves multiple purposes. With 10 kids, any house or apartment would feel like one of those tiny houses on TV. A big rule in our house? Homework was to be done before dinner unless there were extenuating circumstances. That included basketball practices, dance lessons, and after-school meetings, but not TV or playing on a cell phone. This was a rare night with none of those things occurring. All the kids greeted me with smiles and waves. I was rarely much help with their very specific homework assignments, but I was great for moral support. I sat on the couch and knew better than to turn on the news. I gazed out the wide windows to catch a glimpse of the Hudson River. Chrissy hopped onto the couch next to me. She didn't say anything. Just smiled and started reading a book about a young girl who volunteered after 9/11. I'd like to see her read nonfiction books occasionally. I could tell when she was really concentrating and when she was faking it. When concentrating, her brow furrowed. She could really focus. When she was faking it, her eyes darted around the room and she finished a page every 6 minutes. I said, "What's wrong, Pumpkin?"
"I don't feel like doing my reading for today. I keep trying, but I just can't get excited about it."
"Do you like the book?"
"Oh, yeah, it's really good. I just don't like the way people have been talking about you. I don't understand why people are mad at you."
I sighed. "Neither do I." There was a long pause, then Chrissy said,
"Are you sorry you shot that man?"
I draped an arm across her shoulders and pulled her tight. Kids really do know the right questions to ask. I've been struggling with the shooting, reliving it over and over again, dreaming about it. And my little girl had crystallized one of the main issues. I regretted the shooting, but I couldn't apologize for wanting to live. I said quietly, "I am sorry. I'm sorry I had no choice. I had to shoot that man if I wanted to have chats like this with a girl like you. Sometimes in life things like this happen. Then you have another choice. You can let it bother you the rest of your life and affect how you act, or you can appreciate the extra time you have. Every time I look in your face, or one of your brothers' or sisters' faces, I thank God that I'm alive." She gave me a quick hug. As she was about to scoot off the couch, Mary Catherine reappeared. She said,
"Room for one more?"
Chrissy immediately squealed, "Yes!" and scooted in next to me so Mary Catherine would sandwich her between us. Mary Catherine looked at me like she needed permission to join us. I said, "I'm thinking." Mary Catherine dropped a pitch of her voice and said, "Don't think too long." "Okay, maybe you can join us this once." I suspected the errant elbow I caught in the face as she slipped past me to sit next to Chrissy was no accident. Chapter 24. Chrissy dozed off on the couch next to me, and Mary Catherine moved so she could snuggle up close. Now I was the middle of the sandwich. Mary Catherine dropped her head on my shoulder and said, "I'm sorry I blew up, Michael." I lifted my head and stared at her. She said,
"What? What's wrong?"
"I almost thought I heard you apologize. I'm worried you might have suffered a head injury, or perhaps we'll have to call my grandfather to complete an exorcism. This doesn't sound like my Mary Catherine." She punched me in the arm, hard enough to hurt, but not hard enough for me to whine about it. She said,
"I'm serious. I'm sorry I lost control. I also think we should talk about it."
"About going back to work?" "You knew it was going to happen."
"Well, not this fast. You've been through something traumatic. We all have. Don't you think you need some time to recover?"
I thought about how much to tell her. Then I said, "It's not exactly like I'm back on the street. At least it's not my usual assignment. I'm working a missing persons case."
"Really? I thought you only worked homicides."
I explained to her my meeting with the mayor. Not in great detail. I remember the admonition to keep things quiet, but I couldn't just lie to my fiancé. When I was finished, Mary Catherine said,
"What's he like, the mayor?"
I shrugged. "He's a politician, but he's not quite that dick everyone makes him out to be. Talking to him, I had the sense that he was a concerned father. I understood that. Well, everyone has their good and bad. Is that an Irish saying?
No, Reader's Digest.
Mary Catherine looked at me with those big, beautiful eyes and said, "Could you have refused?" I could have, but...
But what?
I could hear in her voice she was getting annoyed again. I blurted out, "It might help Brian." I told her what the mayor had said about making some phone calls.
"Is that right? Is it right to use a person's position, like the mayor's, to help your family? Can he even make a promise like that?"
I said he didn't promise anything. Mary Catherine said,
"But is it right to use his position like that?"
"No, probably not. Do you want me to refuse?"
"No way. I want Brian back. I miss him."
I said, "Exactly. Everyone is an idealist until the issue affects them." I knew I was going to do what I had to do. Chapter 25. Alice Groff and Janos Titan had to move on to someone else after they eliminated Tommy Payne from their list. The next nerd they started looking for was named Jennifer Chang. Alice had one photograph of her. She was a really cute 24-year-old Asian woman from Los Angeles. They didn't have a lot on her other than a couple of possible addresses and the fact that she lived with another computer genius named Oscar Gonzalez. Alice smiled at a line Henry had written in his notes about her. He pointed out the fact that her relationship with Oscar was platonic. That immediately told Alice that Henry was interested in Jennifer for more than her computer skills. At the end of the notes, Henry had added that she was not to be hurt, no matter what. Alice also smiled at the idea of someone telling her how to do her job. She hurt people. That's what she got paid for. She wouldn't let something like an infatuation interfere with her job. If the cute Miss Chang didn't want to get hurt, she should do as they say. Henry needed to think with his head more. He also shouldn't show vulnerabilities like that. Henry wasn't like a drug lord or a Russian gangster. He wasn't so ruthless that he would track people down for a slight to his honor. But he was relying more and more on the two crazy Dutchmen he used as muscle. They were always eager to show how tough they were. Alice had no desire to tangle with them. Janos looked at the notes and said, "So all we do is ask Jennifer to come back with us, nothing more."
"Are you certain? It doesn't help Henry's business reputation if we let this girl walk."
"What are you saying? Kill her even if we don't have to? That's no business. That's just weird."
Janos turned to stare at Alice. A smile crept over his face.
"Or is there something else? Are you jealous of young Jennifer? Is that why you want to put a bullet in her?"
Alice was silent for a while. Finally, she said,
"Not jealous in a romantic way. Henry prizes these computer people, but barely acknowledges our contributions to his business."
"He recognizes us with cash. I'll take that any day. So let's not hurt this girl. Please tell me you're smart enough to know not to harm a purple-dyed hair on Jennifer Chang's pretty head."
Alice frowned but managed to avoid an overt promise, and they went about their business. One of the addresses they had was a brownstone in Queens. They were dressed professionally today and expected this to be a simple visit. Janos was even wearing a tie he'd bought from a place called Daffy's, not far from Times Square. They found the apartment door on the first floor but got no answer. Janos slipped a credit card out of his pocket. Alice said,
"What are you going to do with that?"
"I saw this on TV. I'm going to jiggle the lock open."
"What TV show?"
"I saw it at home. It's an American show. The Rockford Files."
Alice shook her head, knowing it would never work. After a short and furious bout of wiggling the card, Janos got frustrated and used his shoulder to smash in the door. The flimsy door frame snapped on the inside, and they found themselves staring at an empty apartment. Not just that no one was home. There was no furniture or clothing. Alice mumbled, "Damn. On their way out of the building, a young man was now sitting on the stairs, navigating a Samsung tablet. He looked up and smiled. "Are you guys looking for Oscar?" Alice kept Janos from saying something stupid. She immediately said,
"Why, you know where he is?"
"Are you from Columbia or Fordham?" This time Janos spoke. "Columbia. Do you know where Oscar moved?"
"Yeah, he and Jennifer found a place near Midtown. It's above a warehouse that holds caskets and funeral parlor accessories, like a wholesaler."
He gave them directions. Alice stood behind the young man as he spoke with Janos. She started to calculate the odds of leaving a witness like this behind. If something happened, and an investigator was thorough enough, this young man might be able to provide a description of them. That went against her professional ethics. Never leave viable witnesses. She slowly slipped her right hand into her purse and felt the handles of her garrote. The young man was oblivious as he engaged Janos. Alice tried to assess if she really needed to eliminate a witness or just thought she might enjoy it. If she was honest with herself, she didn't mind feeling people struggle under the power of her arms and shoulders focused on the wire of the garrote. To be on the safe side, she pulled it from her purse, both hands ready to go. Janos had all the information he needed. He thanked the young man and took a few steps down the stairs to the street. Alice was still in a perfect position to act. Then the young man said, "I've applied to Columbia. Do you think you guys could help me?" Before Alice could do anything, he jumped right into his pitch. It covered his academic career since middle school. He had 2 years of college and was hoping to get in and finish at Columbia. The young man brushed hair out of his eyes as he finished up. "I have enough financial aid lined up along with money for my parents. I'm not a computer genius like Oscar or Jennifer, but I have really good grades and I'm interested in business." He sounded proud of himself as he finished his list of accomplishments, from being in the marching band in high school to having straight A's at SUNY Brookhaven. Alice held up her homemade garrote. Then she caught Janos waving her off. Her partner said to the young man, "You seem like a good kid, but you need to aim lower." Janos gave him a thumbs up and added, "Hang in there." Alice decided the conversation was too bizarre for the young man to ever think they would be involved in crime. She slipped the garrote back into her purse and hurried down the stairs to catch up with Janos. Janos had a wide grin on his face and said, "Did you hear my good American accent? That kid totally believed I worked for Columbia University." Occasionally, Alice really enjoyed working with her goofy partner. Chapter 26. It felt good to be back on the job, and having a different assignment helped make it interesting. If you don't get something out of your job other than money, what's the point? One of the things I love about police work is that you never know what might happen. I live my life in a constant state of surprise and excitement. Not a bad way to spend your time. Over the years, I'd explored the idea of applying to the FBI or pursuing promotions within the NYPD, but days like this always convinced me that being a detective was the best possible position. Not just any kind of detective, but an NYPD detective. To roam over this great city and meet interesting people made me excited to start work almost every day. I had a list of names the mayor had given me. They were acquaintances or friends of Natalie's. I had spoken to the mayor's ex-wife, who now lived north of Albany. She knew more about her daughter's day-to-day life and friends, but offered nothing of great importance. At least nothing that looked important at the moment. I'd seen divorce ruin families. I got the idea that the divorce was only part of this dynamic, though the mayor himself had taken the blame. The mayor's ex-wife had started to worry about her daughter a while ago. She felt a rising fear of a parent. She didn't care what I did or who I was, as long as I found her daughter. I spoke to a bright young woman named Allie Andrus, who was a senior at NYU. She had been friends with Natalie since middle school. I thought I'd get some real insights, but all she said was that they had drifted apart. Now Natalie hung out with a group of computer hackers. Allie used the phrase cyberpunks. That sounded a little dismissive to me. I spoke to two other friends on the phone and then landed on the name Thomas Paine. When I ran the name through NYPD computer indexes, I was shocked to learn he was a victim of a homicide. His body had been found a few blocks from Penn Station. That changed everything. It could be a coincidence, but if you believe in coincidence, you probably shouldn't be a cop. I immediately got on the horn and reached Detective Ed Arris. He gave me directions to Payne's apartment and said he'd meet me in a few minutes. Ed and I went back a few years. He was 6'4", but had more bulk than me. Some of it had to do with his football career. He played at Hofstra about the same time as their best-known NFL player, Wayne Corbett. He shook my hand, then enveloped me in a bear hug.
"Good to see you, Mike. We've all been worried about you."
I waved off the sentiment, but it touched me. I had to change the subject, quick. I said, "How do you like Manhattan South?"
"You know how it is. I've been up in the Bronx a while. NYPD likes to spread out their black detectives. This is a pretty easy gig compared to the Bronx. I figured I'd pull the plug in the next 10 years anyway."
I noticed how well kept the building was as we walked to the front door of the apartment. There was no doorman, but the electronic security was outstanding. 4 different cameras caught the front of the building. An expensive awning covered the sidewalk leading to the entrance. Ed said they had no leads, just a body that had been strangled with a ligature. In this case, he thought it was some kind of wire. Ed said,
"Screwed up the victim's neck pretty bad. Deep laceration, but it didn't sever any arteries. The poor kid choked to death. He was dead at least 12 hours before someone from a restaurant next door noticed the body jammed up against a wall behind a row of parked cars. The kid's family is devastated."
Every homicide detective knew the feeling. Talking to a family who had just lost someone, death notifications were one of the worst parts of the job. Ed fumbled with the keys, then we ducked under some yellow crime scene tape across the doorway. As soon as we stepped into the apartment and I saw the 2 TVs and all the computer equipment, I knew this was related to the missing Natalie London. Chapter 27. It's always a surreal experience to be in the apartment of a dead person. Their life is told in the belongings they left behind. Secrets are held in correspondence and emails. Even their TV viewing habits might be looked at. Anything that could give a detective a hint of what led to the homicide. Cops like to say a good homicide detective is born, not made. The gift has more to do with the determination to keep looking at things until they make sense. With all the new forms of communication, from instant messaging to email, investigations have changed dramatically. More opportunities to catch a killer also means more information to pore over. Cases, at least more complicated cases, take longer. I believe experience is what makes a good detective. Varied experience, not the same one over and over. Experience is a tricky thing. You never realize how important it is until you gain it. The ultimate catch-22. This was a very nice 2-bedroom apartment most professionals would kill to live in. Somehow, a 24-year-old computer whiz had found a way to pay for it. Ed proceeded to brief me as we walked through the apartment. He said, "We found an airline ticket to Estonia." Immediately, I thought about the wire from Danske Bank in Estonia that paid for Natalie London's apartment. Things were starting to pop. Ed continued, "The victim had a Long Island Rail ticket to Hempstead in his pocket. The fairly big town, I think it's the biggest in Nassau County. You have relatives there?" Ed said, "I spoke to his parents who live in Hicksville. They weren't expecting him. Of course, they're in shock. The only thing they could think of is that his grandmother has a house in Hempstead she lets him use. I looked up the address. Good place to lie low. It would be hard to connect it to him." I said, "You think he had a change of heart about the trip to Estonia? Maybe he was running?" Ed finished my thought. And whoever he was running from caught him. It's possible. We have some grainy surveillance photographs that show him leaving Penn Station with a couple. A well-dressed white woman and man in their 30s. Not enough to make an exact ID, but the surveillance cameras downstairs show what may be the same couple visiting the building earlier that evening. Excellent images, but not a single match in our system, and they may have been visiting someone other than Payne. This one really has us stumped. No drug connections? That was usually the first and most likely reason for a homicide in New York. No, nothing. He'd been in school until 18 months ago. His parents pay for this apartment? Nope. Interesting. And confusing. I can't find what the kid did for money, but he was doing okay. Well, I'd say so. I had told him I was looking for a witness. Technically, it was true. I had been waiting for the next question. Ed said, what's the connection between the witness you're looking for and Payne? Can the witness help me on this homicide? Truthfully, I don't know. But if I ever find her, it'll be one of my first questions. What kind of case is she a witness to? Ed, this is going to sound weird coming from me, but I can't talk about it. It was embarrassing to tell one of my brother cops something like that. The FBI did that kind of shit all the time. That's why none of the local cops worked with him much. I didn't like saying it to a fellow detective. But he took it in stride, and we continued exchanging a little information and looking through the apartment again. Finally, I said, okay, Ed, I've seen enough. Will you keep me in the loop? Sure, no problem. Will you do the same? As soon as I'm authorized, you'll hear the whole story. For now, I have to shift my focus to another witness. Down here in Manhattan South, I have a lot of contacts. I think I need to go to Columbia first. Last I heard, she was registered there. Ed said, I seem to recall you having a little trouble at Columbia not that long ago. Will they let you on campus? They're not known to help the police much. I have a few contacts. I need to find this girl. I'll see what I can pick up on her and if she knows anything about your victim. Is this witness's name a secret too? No, not really. Her name is Jennifer Chang. She's a computer genius too. That's why I think it might all be related. Ed laughed and said, if you don't know it by now, everything's related in police work. Chapter 28. I hadn't been to Columbia University in some time. During my last visit, looking into rumors of a teenage hitman, I'd found the student studying at Columbia's Butler Library. The young man was bright and eloquent. He was also an armed psychopath, which became clear when he pulled a pistol on me while we were chatting. We're credited with the only running gunfight in history inside a Columbia library. Thinking about that shooting and my most recent shooting left me feeling a little dejected. It really did seem like people were much more open to using violence to get away from the police. It made me scared for the generations of cops to come. A security guard at the campus was a retired NYPD sergeant. It was clear on the phone he didn't want anyone to see him talking to a current NYPD detective, but he did a search of the university's records and found that Jennifer Chang was an enrolled student. There was no way to tell if she was attending her classes, but he knew some of the university's IT people. That's where I was headed, north of the main campus. I should have picked up on his tone and chuckle. He said, Jason is a little different. How so? Let's just say he lives in his own world, played by his rules, and he could be a big help. I found the offices not far from the Hudson in a four-story brick and glass building that looked more like a large warehouse than a hub of technology. I entered the front door, and the first thing I saw was a page of copy paper with the word infrastructure scribbled on it with a ballpoint pen. An arrow pointed down. I took the narrow staircase next to the sign. It felt a little like a horror movie. The underground floor was poorly lit, and there was no one around. Literally. I had not seen one person since I entered the building. I found another sign just like the first one with an arrow pointing to the end of the hallway. My shoes echoed off the concrete floor, which looked just as cold as the colorless walls. A stale odor assaulted my nose. Finally, I found a door with one more matching sign that said infrastructure. I knocked and heard someone shout from inside. I opened the door and saw a man, about 30, with long red hair tied in a ponytail. He looked up and said, "Are you Bennett?" I nodded. "Todd in security told me you'd be coming. He said you were trustworthy and on a noble quest. I respect anyone on a noble quest." It took me a moment to realize this guy had played one too many Dungeons and Dragons games. He said, "My name is Jason, Jason A. Manafort. But Todd said you wouldn't put my name in any reports. Can I trust your word of honor, sir?" "No one will ever know I was here or that you spoke to me." "And your quest, is it really noble?" "I'm looking for a missing girl, and Jennifer Chang might know where to find her. I just want to make sure she's safe." I waited while Jason considered this. He wasn't taking our encounter lightly. I wasn't sure if that was good or bad. Then Jason patted the seat next to him and turned to his computer monitor. He said, "I did a little background. I needed to meet you and make sure you were worthy of receiving this information." I watched as he brought up Jennifer Chang's registration information. I copied down an address in Midtown. It looked like more of a warehouse area. Some of the warehouses had apartments above them. I also looked at Jennifer's official school ID photo. Like most college students, she looked too young to be in school, but that was just a product of me getting older. She was cute and had purple streaks running through her hair. She had been born in California and appeared to be of Asian descent. Nothing in her file was useful for my investigation, other than the address, which I intended to visit as soon as I was done with the royal handler of information. I talked with Jason for a few more minutes and asked if there was anything else he thought might help.